Herbert Schlosser.
No matter what anyone else tells you, the guy who created the show and made it what it is Lorne Michaels.
Dick Ebersol.
If you asked Lorne what I contributed to the show, what I think he would say is that during the development stage and the launch, I created an island on which he could exist and no one else could touch him. Michaels continued his search for talent, listening to suggestions from network executives that he never for a moment considered, protected to some degree by Ebersol from direct interference. Some performers had to be pursued, others threw themselves at Michaels. He also relied on the many contacts he'd made as a performer and writer in Canada, and on talent gleaned from improvisational groups like Chicago's and Toronto's Second City, and the Groundlings in Los Angeles.
Dave Wilson, director.
I got involved because I was editing a show called A Salute to Sir Lou Grade. British television decided to salute him on his 80th birthday or whatever it was, and they did an all-star show at the New York Hilton. Gary Smith and Dwight Hemian were actually the producers, but they couldn't stay, so they left it all in my hands to get edited. And while I was editing, the production assistant on the show said she was going for an interview. There was a new show starting at NBC, some late-night thing that a Canadian kid was going to be producing. And I said, "Oh, what's it called?" And she said, "I don't know, I think it's called Saturday Night." I said, "Isn't that Howard Cosell and Rune Arledge at ABC?" And she said, "Oh, no, that's the prime-time Saturday Night. This is the late-night Saturday Night." I called my manager and said I was interested and could he get me an interview. The funny thing about it was I had to fight with my manager. He kept saying, "Oh, you don't want to get involved with a late-night thing. You want to be involved with a prime-time show." I said, "No, I don't want to be involved with a prime-time show. This late-night show looks like it's got some very interesting people involved." I got an interview in a weird way, too, because Lorne wasn't seeing anybody. I guess he had just had it with people being forced down his throat. But luckily my manager was a very good friend of Bernie Brillstein, and I had worked with Bernie on a Muppet show, Sex and Violence with the Muppets. And Bernie said, "I know Dave Wilson, he gets along great with Jim Henson, and if he can get along great with Jim Henson, he can get along great with anybody." So he put in the word to Lorne that maybe I was somebody he'd be interested in seeing.
Howard Shore.
I actually had to find the band. I'm an avid collector of music and of jazz and R&B, and I just called people I'd listened to on records. I got in touch with as many people as I could that I was interested in. I knew they were in New York. I started to put the band together, started to write original music for the show, themes and original music for the band itself. The Carson show was big band music. Although I sort of grew up in that a bit in the 50s, Glenn Miller and Ellington and Basie I listened to, the big band thing was not really my generation. My generation was more R&B and rock and roll.
Paul Schaefer, musician.
Howard Shore called me to be in his new band for Saturday Night Live. Howard had worked for me in a theatrical show in Toronto on saxophone. I was conducting Godspell, the Toronto company. We had a wonderfully talented cast. Gilda was in the cast. Also Andrea Martin, Eugene Levy, Marty Short, and Dave Thomas, among others. These were the funniest people I'd ever come in contact with. I met Lorne up in his 17th floor office. For some reason I have this recollection of him looking at two pots of coffee brewing and saying, "Which one of these coffees is fresher?" And I'll always remember that. I thought, this is a guy who speaks in comedic pentameter. I remember that, and the fact that his skin was all broken out because he was nervous. He was putting this show together from scratch, and he hadn't hired anybody yet.
Dave Wilson.
I first met with Lorne up on 17 in his office, back in the days when he was wearing a T-shirt that said "Dracula sucks" and jeans and a ponytail. I was there in my interview suit. I remember coming home from the interview and telling my wife, "Well, I guess I didn't get that job," because Lorne kept saying things like, "This is a young person's medium," and "I'm going to go off in a new direction." Luckily, by happenstance, he also said, For example, our first host is going to be George Carlin. Do you think you and he could understand each other? What he didn't know, and what I wasn't even sure that George would remember, is that George and I went to camp together as kids. So I said, "Of course. George Carlin and I are old friends. Old, old friends from when we were like little kids." And he said, "I'm going out to the coast to meet with him. I'll say hello for you." I kept praying, "I hope George Carlin remembers me after this whole thing." Turns out he did, and Lauren, I guess, was sort of impressed by that. Then I went for a second interview and got the job. Dick Ebersol. We were walking through the rain one night after dinner, sort of going from awning to awning, and Chevy ran ahead. A couple hundred feet away he goes into a pothole, does a complete ass-over tea kettle into this immense pothole, and comes out of this thing just soaked. And he walks back, and he and Lauren look at me and say, "Now, how could you say no to somebody who was crazy enough to do that?" So Chevy became a cast member, and he ended up with a magnificent loophole, since he had already signed a 1-year contract as head writer. From the time the show launched, every time the performer contract was put in front of him, it never got signed. Bernie Brillstein. I had to call Gilda Radner in Vancouver and urge her not to do the David Steinberg show, a syndicated show. It was an offer she'd been considering. I had never met Gilda. That's how I got to know her, over the phone. I made her laugh, you know. Lorne, of course, wouldn't make the call himself, so I had to do it. Even then, there was no direct route. Why it's that way with him, I don't know. Fear of rejection, I guess. And clean hands, you know, it's like I have nothing to do with it. Dick Ebersol. Late April, early May, Lauren started laying out the cast. One day he's got this really bizarre guy with smoked glasses, Michael O'Donohue, and I'm thinking, "Oh, God, what have we gotten into here?" And then one day he told me, "This girl is the funniest thing and just a superhuman being. You're going to be crazy about her." Because I had okay over these people. So this thin young woman shows up with a kid who says hello and excuses himself. But the woman is Gilda. And here I am talking to this young comedic actress, and I'm absolutely mesmerized by her. So she's the first person signed to do the show after Lorne. Dan Aykroyd, cast member. I went through so many auditions, live auditions, tape auditions. After the first one, I thought, I'm not going to get hired. And I ended up driving across country with John Candy to do Second City in Pasadena. We went from Toronto to L.A. in 38 hours in a big old Mercury with switching off driving. And then we got to Pasadena, and I started my first week of rehearsals, and Lorne called and said, "Well, come back out." So, at my own expense, I got on a fucking plane, flew back to New York, and had this other series of tape auditions. I think I did, like, newscaster guy, announcer guy type of thing, and if anything got me on the show, it was that type of fast rap announcer, the Ron Popeil sort of thing. There was one audition in the summer, a live thing, a cattle call. I came down with a friend from Toronto. We had a song prepared, but then I saw all the people lined up waiting outside in the hall there. There were 100 people waiting to get in, and I was at the end of the line. And I thought, boy, it's 3 o'clock now. It's going to be 7 o'clock at night when we get on. This song ain't going to go over too well. So I just kind of cut through the line and busted into the room, because I knew Lorne from Canada, and walked up. "Hey, how are you, boss? What are you doing? Nice to see you," I said. "Well, I'm here." And I did a sort of quick 5-minute kind of fast rap and then got out of there. And I think they were impressed. After that audition, it was clear I had the job. I went home to Canada, got my motorcycle, and drove down into the city for the first season in 75. I had just turned 23. Paul Schaefer. Gilda and I had both worked on the National Lampoon Radio Hour here in New York, so we became friendly with John Belushi and Doug Kenny in this cast of characters associated with the Lampoon. I remember Gilda was trying to get Belushi hired for Saturday Night Live. A lot of people were telling Lorne he had to hire Belushi. And I remember seeing Gilda with Belushi one day, and she said, "We're sitting Shiva because Lorne won't hire John." Chevy Chase, cast member. In fact, Belushi was an afterthought. I mean, he had told Lorne at some point that he was not enchanted with TV per se, and he didn't want to do TV. And Lorne didn't particularly care if he saw him or didn't see him. Then John did an audition, and Lorne said, "Well, he's funny, and we could use somebody who looks like him." Dan Aykroyd. Lorne was concerned that Belushi and I would be a duo that would give him a lot of trouble. He thought, "Oh, get these guys together and their strength will be my weakness because they'll be rebels." And you know, in a way, he was right. Certainly there was an energy around us. John was a kid out of Chicago, the Chicago Second City Troupe, and I was out of the Second City in Toronto. I came from the capital city of Ottawa, the child of two government workers. His father ran a restaurant, was in private business. But we grew up loving the same things. The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, old black-and-white TV. When we first came up with the Blues Brothers, that was prior to SNL. John came up to Toronto to recruit for the National Lampoon Radio Hour. That's when I first met him. He managed to get Gilda to come down to New York to work with him. I had this gig on a kids' TV show at 4 p.m. I had my job at Second City. I did radio and television commercials, and I had my speakeasy bar, which was all cash, no tax. So I was flush. I had rockets going everywhere. I was making more money than the Prime Minister of Canada. I had a car, a bike, an apartment in the city, my tent at the farm. I was living a beautiful life up there. There was no way I wanted to go to the States.
Judith Belushi, writer. In John's first interview with Lorne, one of the first things he said was, "My television has spit all over it." That's how he felt about television. He was asked to do a few television things. He was offered a guest shot on Mary Tyler Moore, which everyone thought could easily turn into a character role. And it was kind of a big deal to say no. He even liked Mary Tyler Moore. But he needed to be political and outrageous.
Lorne Michaels. I'd worked in television for 8 years, so I was bored with people who go, "I don't do television." I had no patience for it, for people putting it down. They say, "I'm not doing television," and then I go, "Well, then there's no point to us talking." I told John, "I hear what you're doing is great, but I don't want you to have to do something that you don't want to do." My instinct was that he was going to be trouble.
Judith Belushi. John went to talk to Lorne because he said, "Well, if he's hiring O'Donohue and Ann Beats and Gilda..." They were people John liked working with, and so he figured the show was going to be something different. Ann Beats. They had been paying us the same amount, which was a big $750 a week. You can imagine, if we were happy to accept free restaurant meals from the Village Voice, $750 a week represented a considerable sum to us in those days. I mean, our rent was $675 a month, which everyone thought was just horrendously high for what Belushi called the Winter Palace on 16th Street. And then NBC told me, "Oh, we're not supposed to be paying you as much as Michael. We've been paying you $750 a week, but that's a mistake, and we want the money back." They said it had been a bookkeeping error. And I basically said, "Go fuck yourself. You know, the money's gone, and you're not getting it back. Furthermore, you better start paying me $750 a week. Why shouldn't I make the same as him? I don't know, because he had more credits or something? Or because he had a penis?"
Dick Ebersol. Some of the auditions took place in a Steinway rehearsal hall on West 57th Street. When we came back over to 30 Rock, even after John's incredible audition, Lorne was really troubled about how one could discipline him. John was always the best person available in New York, bar none. But he always made it perfectly clear that he thought television was shit. Everything about television was shit, and yet he kept showing up for all these meetings and auditions. And Lorne was very worried about it. Finally, on the day the decision was made, the three of us, Michael, Ann Beats, and I, really argued for John in a big way. And I think Lorne said at the time The thing that finally turned his mind was I said I would take responsibility for him. I made a vow to Lorne that if he's the nightmare some people think he'll be, I'll take care of him. I'll be the minder of Belushi, which led to some awfully fun stuff for me, including him almost burning my house down. He did the same thing to Lorne's place in New York.
Judith Belushi. Just before John and I were married, I kicked him out of the house for this or that, and he went and stayed at Lorne's place. He fell asleep with a cigarette going, and the mattress caught on fire. He didn't burn the whole place down, but I'm sure it caused some damage. Lorne called me afterward and said, "Can I send him home now?"
Bernie Brillstein. I went down there after the fire, and there were odors I had never smelled before in my life. I mean, it was terrible. I was an old guy. I was used to comedians in tuxedos and ties. Chevy Chase. John was wonderful. He was trouble later on for me. Jesus, oh God, was he trouble. Garrett Morris, cast member. I'd been a licensed schoolteacher, taught 2 years at PS 71 in New York, plus 5 years at the projects with drug-addicted kids. And you know what? I hadn't worked in like a fucking year and a half. I'd done Cooley High, and that was it. I left the school system to go back into a thing called Hallelujah, Baby. My license had even expired. I didn't have a job. I was starving. So Lorne offered me a job. I won't tell you how much it was, but it was good money.
Lorraine Newman, cast member. I worked for Lorne for the first time on a Lily Tomlin special. He had come to see me when we had just formed the Groundlings, and we had our theater over on Oxford and Santa Monica. It was just the armpit of Hollywood, and he came to see the show. I was doing my characters and my monologues. They really were looking for men for the Lily Tomlin special. They didn't need any more women. But they ended up hiring me, and that was just thrilling. I was 22. The following year, Lorne told me he had been approached to do a weekend replacement show for The Tonight Show and said it would be a cross between Monty Python and 60 Minutes. And I thought, I'd watch that, you know? It was a big break, and I thought, this'll be great. Jane Curtin, cast member. John and I were the last two people hired, and John was hired about a week after me, so I didn't have any idea what was going on there. But I knew John, because John and I were also auditioning for the Howard Cosell show, so I was working with John in those auditions, too. He was much sweeter back then, I think because he couldn't afford the drugs. He was more in control. He was accessible. I actually liked him when we were working on the Cosell show auditions. I thought he was a lot of fun, and I thought he was very talented. And then when he got hired by Saturday night, I thought it was a very good idea.
Lorne Michaels. Gilda and John and Danny had known each other from before. Danny and I had known each other because when I came down, I brought him down from Canada. Gilda and I went back forever. And so you had Lorraine, who I brought from L.A., Jane Curtin, who we kind of heard about, and the girl we were going to choose, this girl named Mimi Kennedy. But Gilda was worried that they were too similar. Garrett Morris. The way I got on the show as an actor is that a couple people on the writing staff were trying to get rid of me as a writer. Mind you, I had two plays that had been produced in New York City. In fact, New York commissioned a play from your boy, okay? And then I wrote another play, which was produced in New York and in L.A. I'm a playwright, so I was having trouble getting my stuff down to a minute or a minute and a half to fit into some sketch. The first 3 months or so, a guy there stole an idea and then added a little something to it, and he didn't even give me credit for co-writing. This guy stole from me and then told Lorne I couldn't write. Lorne's response was even-tempered. He wasn't necessarily stroking me like I was a pet, but he was fair. When the challenge came to get rid of me as a writer, Lorne let me audition for the Not Ready for Primetime Players. He did not fire me. And to this day, I am thankful for that. So I got with the Not Ready for Primetime Players, and the look on that guy's face for the next 4 years was the only thing that saved me from jumping on him.
Bernie Brillstein. Lorne really stuck to his guns at the very beginning. He told the network, "I must have 17 shows. Give the show time to grow." They thought we were insane, and maybe we were. But it wasn't until the 10th show that they really hit their stride. Lorne was this great young writer who had this vision of this type of show. He was also a good producer, but everybody forgets what a great writer he was, and certainly a great editor. He was like a conduit for all the comedy brains at the time. He was just the guy. John Landis, film director. This is all hindsight, okay? I don't want to take anything away from Lorne, but he was in the right place at the right time. There were comedy movements going on everywhere. In England, you had the Pythons. In San Francisco, you had the Committee. In Chicago, you had Second City. And then in New York, starting in Boston, but then moving to New York, you had the National Lampoon Show. If you look at Saturday Night Live's cast for the first 3 or 4 years, you'll see they were all either Lampoon or Second City. He cherry-picked people of great skill and talent that had been trained and gotten their chops.
Barbara Gallagher, associate producer. Lorne was very shy, very funny, kind of quiet. We were exactly the same age. He called me and said that Dick Ebersol and he were going to do a show. It sounded like a, "Look, we've got a barn and we're going to put on a show," kind of thing. And because I'd had live TV experience by working on the Ed Sullivan Show, Lorne wanted me to come and write and be part of the team. I didn't want to go back to New York, and I didn't want to be a writer. So Lorne said, "How about creative associate producer? I just like the fact you've been on a live show." So I said, okay. I went back to New York in June of 1975. I didn't have a clue what the show was going to be. It just sounded fun and kind of groundbreaking.
Eugene Lee, set designer. I can remember Lorne, he would not remember, saying to me, "God, this is going to be so great. We all get to just hang out in New York together." I was living on a sailboat in Rhode Island, working with what was then called the Trinity Square Repertory Company, where I still work, and someone called my boat about this Canadian producer doing a comedy variety show. They wanted to know if we, my wife Fran, a costume designer, and I, would be interested in talking. He was at the Plaza, we could call and make an appointment. Well, why not? Alan Swy Bell, writer. In 1975, I'm this Jewish guy slicing God knows what at a deli in Queens and selling jokes to these Catskill comics for $7 a joke. At night, I would go on at Catch a Rising Star. I had taken all the jokes that the Borscht Belt comedians wouldn't buy from me because they said the stuff was too risque for their crowd and made them into a stand-up act for myself, hoping that somebody would come in, like the material, and give me a job in television. Everybody hung out at Catch a Rising Star and the Improv in those days, and I'd just met Billy Crystal, who was starting out the same way. He lived on Long Island, 3 towns over from where I was living with my parents. He was married and had a kid already. We would carpool into the city every night. One night, about 4 months into this horror show, it's about 1 in the morning, and I'm having trouble making these 6 drunks from Des Moines laugh, and I get off the stage sweating like a pig, and I go over to the bar, and I'm waiting for Billy to tell his jokes so he can drive me home to Long Island. And this guy sits down next to me and just stares at me. Stares at me. And I look over. "What?" And he just looks at me and he goes, "You know, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my life." And I went, "Yeah, I know." I said that I wanted to have a wife and kids someday, but they'd starve if something else didn't happen soon. He said, "Your material's not bad. Did you write it?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can I see more?" And I said, "You bet." I didn't even ask who he was. I mean, I would have shown it to a gardener at this point. But it was Lorne, and he was combing the clubs looking for writers and actors for this new show. So I went back to Long Island, and I stayed up for 2 days straight, and I typed up what I thought were 1,100 of my best jokes. Jokes that I wrote for the Borscht Belt comics, jokes that I practiced writing for other comics, jokes I heard in 3rd grade, I mean, I just went nuts. and so I took my phone book full of jokes and went into the city for my interview with Lorne. Oh, but first I called Billy Crystal, because he had been talking to Lorne about him being a part of the show from the beginning, either as a cast member or some sort of rotating player. So I said, "Look, I'm supposed to meet with this guy Lorne. Can you tell me anything about him?" So Billy told me he used to submit jokes to Woody Allen, he's produced a Monty Python special, and the new show is going to have these little films by Albert Brooks. Oh, and he hates mimes. Lorne hates mimes. So I said, fine. I went over to the Plaza Hotel and met with Lorne. He takes the phone book of jokes, opens it, reads the first jokes, and goes, "Uh-huh," and closes it. And he says, "How much money do you need to live?" I said, "Well, I'm making $2.75 at the deli. Match it." So he said to tell him more about myself. He figured before he'd commit to that kind of money, he wanted to know what he was buying. I said, "Well, Woody Allen's my idol. I love Monty Python, and maybe my career will go like Albert Brooks's, you know, short films and then bigger ones. But," I said, "if there's one fucking mime on the show, I'm out of there." And he gives me the job. The joke that I had as the number one joke in this compilation of jokes was, just to show you how long ago this was, because of the reference in it, was that the post office was about to issue a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It's a 10-cent stamp, but if you want to lick it, it's a quarter. We even did it on the show. I remember we were short on jokes. Chevy might have done it. Yeah, I think he did. I think that was my one contribution to the first show, the one that George Carlin hosted.
Rosie Schuster. I read Alan Zweibel's book of one-liners that came to the Marmont and discussed it with Lorne. I remember talking a lot about Chevy as a writer. Marilyn Miller we knew from Lily Tomlin. Ann Beats and Michael O'Donohue were celebrities, especially O'Donohue, who was, you know, the darling of the Lampoon. So they came pre-sold. O'Donohue had a lot of charisma, and he was very dark. He was an exciting character in his subversiveness. Al Franken and Tom Davis were a two-for-one kind of bargain basement. They were just starting, and anxious to get into the business. You know, let's give them a tryout. I was definitely in conversations about all that stuff. Ann Beats. I truly think you can say that without Michael O'Donohue, there wouldn't have been a Saturday Night Live, and I think it's important to remember that. I think Lorne would probably be generous enough to acknowledge that, because I always said Michael was Cardinal Richelieu. He wasn't very good at being the king. He was much better at being either the person plotting revolution or the power behind the throne, telling the king what to do and think. I'm not saying he was manipulating Lorne. It doesn't always have to be about manipulation. It could be about actual helpful guidance.
Al Franken, writer. Tom Davis and I had known each other since high school in Minnesota. In 1974, we were a comedy team out in L.A. We were the only writers hired by Lorne, who he didn't meet. We always thought that if he had met us, we wouldn't have gotten the job. We weren't making money at the time, and the only variety shows around were Johnny Carson's, and we're not joke writers, so we couldn't do that, and Carol Burnett's, which was a good show, but not our territory. Oh, and I think Sonny and Cher was on, which was a piece of shit. Actually, we wrote a perfect submission for Saturday Night Live, a package of things we'd like to see on TV, a news parody, commercial parody, and a couple sketches. Basically, from that, we were hired. We heard that Dick Ebersol wanted to hire a team from New York instead of us so he could save on the airfare, but Lorne insisted on us. Michaels was aghast at the condition of NBC's historic Studio 8H, which, despite its noble traditions, was technically primitive and had been allowed to deteriorate. He didn't think it had hosted a weekly live TV show since Your Hit Parade succumbed to rock and roll and left NBC in 1958. Meanwhile, NBC brass were consumed with nervousness about the content of the show, about giving 90 minutes of network time a week to Lorne Michaels and his left-wing loonies.
On the first show, with sometimes racy comic George Carlin hosting, the network planned to use a 6-second delay so that anything unexpected and obscene could be edited out by an observer from the Department of Standards and Practices, the censor, who would theoretically flip a switch in the control room and bleep the offending material before it went out naked onto the American airwaves. Over the coming months and years, various hosts or musical acts would make NBC executives more nervous than usual, and the notion of making the show not quite precisely literally live kept coming up.
Jane Curtin. NBC sent me out on a limited publicity tour weeks before we went on the air. I didn't really know what the show was going to be like, but I was the only one in the cast that they weren't afraid of. They knew I wouldn't throw my food.
Bernie Brillstein. In the first 6 months, Lorne threatened not to come into work a lot. He had no way of dealing with these network people, because Lorne had a vision, and they didn't understand his vision. This was a new show at that time. He made them rebuild the goddamn studio, and they didn't understand that. And he made them get great sound in the studio, because they were going to have rock acts, and they didn't understand that. Howard Shore. I remember going for that first tour of the studio, and they had game show sets in there, and they were doing very low-tech productions in there, because it didn't have any of the technology that was really needed to do a live broadcast. It was stuck in the late 50s. Bernie Brillstein. When Lorne told NBC they had to spend like $300,000 to rebuild that studio, they nearly had a breakdown.
Barbara Gallagher. Dick Ebersol was really the buffer. He'd worked very hard to get the show on the air, and the NBC guys all thought we were from Mars. The bureaucracy at NBC was terrible. They thought we were a joke at the beginning. Trying to get through the red tape really took a lot of time. We couldn't even get stationery with the show's name printed on it. They had no faith in us at all. The network really irked Lorne at the beginning, big time.
Craig Kellum, associate producer. He was in a constant battle with the network as it pertained to the economics, particularly about the set. Lorne wanted the set to be like almost this architectural prototype. The argument was, hey, you can't even see that on camera. And Lorne's attitude was, yes, but I want it. I want it anyway. Eugene Lee. They hired Dave Wilson to be the director. He'd done a lot of TV. Dave was a nice man, but he had very strong opinions about things and said them. And there was a lot of incredible feuding about the layout of the studio. Dave and I fought tooth and nail about how it would be laid out. I laid it out my way, long ways. There was a lot of muttering about how there wouldn't be enough space. I said, the cameras are on wheels, let the cameras roll to the scenery and not the other way. One day, just out of the blue, Lorne comes by and says, hey, we've got to go upstairs. And I went with him, and we took the model of the set up to whoever, I think it was Herb Schlosser. We laid it on the coffee table, and Lorne hadn't said much about any of this. But he explained it perfectly to Schlosser. He was like brilliant. I mean, really, no kidding. I was knocked out. He said, this thing goes here, and the camera moves here, and it all stretches around this great big environment. And after that, money didn't seem to be a problem. Dave Wilson. The idea of having part of the audience sitting around home base was not that new. I'm sure that kind of thing had been done many times. But the idea of putting an audience in front of those side stages was a little different. It worked well because it gave performers more of an intimate feeling of audience, that they were performing not just for cameras, but for a live audience.